despite his Jewish background. Weinberg's knowledge of Yiddish is limited to words like schmaltz and schmuck, expressions common to all New Yorkers. But the mythical hat burned on his head that night as he sat alone in his room at the Santa Cruz Holiday Inn. He knew he was a swindler, but he hadn't yet swindled anyone in Bolivia. Where had he slipped up? Did they shoot decent, hard-working swindlers in South America? He got the answers early the next morning when he was led into one of the hotel conference rooms. Approximately 30 glowering businessmen, all Bolivians, sat expectantly in their chairs. A high-ranking government official who was running the meeting motioned Weinberg to a chair near the head of the table. Looking around, Weinberg noticed Pacheco, his head bowed, sitting nearby. The government official got to the point quickly. "Mr. Weinberg, these other gentlemen here and I were most eager to do business with you. When Mr. Pacheco came to each of us privately and asked us to advance money for your plane fare and that of your assistants, each of us willingly did so. But you must understand, Bolivia is a small nation. We have all talked to each other. We have discovered that each and every one of us has given the money to Mr. Pacheco for your tickets. Surely you and your assistants do not need 90 round-trip tickets." Weinberg did some fast mental calculations. Each of the first-class tickets, with intermediate stops, was worth about $2,000. That totaled $180,000 for 90 tickets, minus $6,000 for Weinberg's, his friends, and host tickets. That left Pacheco with $174,000. That son of a bitch Pacheco hadn't only swindled the Bolivians. He had swindled Mel Weinberg. Didn't the schmuck realize that these guys were going to talk to each other? He glared over at Pacheco, who wouldn't meet his eyes. Then he went into an act that can only be described as pure Weinberg. He rose from his chair, quickly assuming the expression of shocked hurt befitting an honest banker who has just uncovered a thieving cashier. "Gentlemen," he said, "no one is more amazed and angered to learn of this than I. I trusted this man to be my representative, and he has destroyed my reputation and my business." He scowled at Pacheco. "Look at him. He won't even look at me. Pacheco, what did you do with this money?" He posed the question confidently, knowing that he himself hadn't gotten the money. Pacheco squirmed in his chair. Weinberg read his thoughts. Pacheco undoubtedly suspected that Weinberg was an American mobster. He knew that he had scammed Weinberg, and now shuddered at the thought of his body, air-conditioned by underworld bullets, and lying at the bottom of the ocean in a cement sports jacket. Deciding he was better off in the hands of his own countrymen, he confessed he had scammed the money. Weinberg had relied on what he calls the hope factor when he fingered Pacheco. He knew that the government officials and businessmen were far more angry over the fact that they might not get huge loans because he was a fraud than they were about losing $6,000 each. Now he could see the hope return to their eyes. "This man Weinberg has been betrayed just like we have," their eyes seemed to say. "He is for real. And if he is for real, so are those huge loans that we've been promised from his European banks." They clustered around him, apologizing for their unfounded suspicions. A few of the more emotional ones hugged him in an abrazo. He was most understanding and kind. It was almost impossible, he agreed, to get good help nowadays. A week later, he left Bolivia with nearly $50,000 that he had scammed from government ministers and other businessmen in Santa Cruz and La Paz. "Honesty pays," he chortled. To this day, Weinberg doesn't know what happened to Pacheco. "He's probably working off the dough he owes picking coffee beans on some goddamn plantation," he mused. The rest of South America was a triumphal tour. In Paraguay, Weinberg was the guest of a wealthy rancher who needed a $70 million loan for an irrigation project. Host, a pudgy New Yorker with horn-rimmed glasses, was fascinated with the gaucho lifestyle at the ranch. He started wearing a cowboy hat with his business suit and became a constant target for Weinberg's barbed humor. Weinberg scammed the rancher for $100,000 in advance fees. He took another $40,000 out of Sao Paulo, $20,000 from Rio, and another $20,000 from a Santiago businessman who needed a loan to run the Coca-Cola franchise in Chile. Now Weinberg faced the problem of getting more than $200,000 past U.S. Customs when he landed in Miami. He solved the problem quickly. "I put all the money in my back pockets, and I walked up to the customs guy at the Miami airport," he recalls. "He asked me if I had anything to declare. I said I had nothing except for a couple of ceramic pots that I was carrying in my hands. I'd picked them up in Bolivia so I would look like a tourist." "He asked me if I had anything else," said Weinberg. "I said no, no. I had my raincoat over my arm. I handed it to him. Then I took off my suit jacket and handed him the suit jacket. I'm literally throwing my clothes at him. He backs up and says, 'Okay, okay, I believe you, I believe you.' That's how I walked into the country with $200,000 in my pockets." Once back at the London investor's office in Melville, packages poured in from all over the world. Clients sat in the reception room and stared open-mouthed as host and other staffers rushed back and forth, answering phones, shouting orders, and fighting for space at the telex. They burbled contracts for tallow to Korea, shucked clams for Chile to Ghana, telephone equipment from New York to Rome. They talked easily about letters of commitment, standby loan guarantees, cash flows, depreciation, and relative productivity. It was still a learning time for Weinberg. He began to scan the financial pages of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, to follow the local news and Newsday, and to absorb mini doses of world events from TV. He became adept at the language of finance, and began to fashion his stalls from such current events as a printer's strike in London or a revolution in Lebanon. He kept spending more, however, to maintain the illusion. TriStar Cars Limited, a car rental firm at Heathrow Airport outside London, was typical of the firms exposed to heavy doses of Weinberg's fast-buck philosophy. In a 1976 telex message to London investors in Melville, TriStar wrote, "Your Mr. Weinberg is using credit facilities for chauffeur cars at the rate of £50 per day, and the present balance is £150 and expected to reach £500 this week. As your company is not known to us, we should appreciate your advice of any special invoicing instructions and bank details for credit instructions." Host telexed back a glowing reference for Weinberg and the firm. Interestingly, Weinberg kept his own counsel and masked the true nature of his dealings even at London investors. He saw no point in telling Lady Diane, or even Lou Host, that he was a swindler. "The less anyone knows, the better, even those closest to you," advises Weinberg. He was sure that Host knew, although there were moments when he had doubts. "Lou could be awful dumb at times," he said. "After all, it's not much of a jump from being a thieving businessman to being an out-and-out crook." The peripatetic con man was almost constantly on the move, darting cross-country to various cities where his commission agents opened branch offices for London investors. On these trips he used Lady Diane sparingly, reserving her for only the most important clients. "She was the salad dressing, the schmaltz," he explained. Unaware of the details of his business, in a sense, she was also a victim of his illusion. It was during one such trip to his Las Vegas branch office with Lady Diane that Weinberg was introduced to singer Wayne Newton. Newton at the time was in between fortunes and sought a loan to build a new ranch on land that he owned in Nevada. Weinberg was only too happy to take the package. But he only nicked Newton for $850. Soon, Newton, Weinberg, and Lady Diane became a threesome, though before long it was a twosome. Weinberg was too busy to notice the light in Lady Diane's eyes. One afternoon, while Weinberg and Lady Diane were staying at the Swank Balboa Club in Newport Beach, California, he saw Newton leaving her room. "I'm going back to New York, babe," Weinberg told her.
"Either come with me or stay for him."
Lady Diane accompanied Weinberg on his flight back to New York. Although Weinberg had no way of knowing it at the time, three events took place while he was operating London Investors that would later play a vital part in the formation and execution of the FBI's Abscam investigation. The first was a casual brush with Meyer Lansky, the dyspeptic old crook who functions as a sort of House of Rothschild to organize crime. The second was a chance meeting in the first-class section of a Pan-American 747 with a wealthy Arab businessman. And the third was a routine front-end swindle of a Pittsburgh real estate man named Lee Schlag. It was Weinberg's casual relationship with the FBI as a tipster that indirectly put him on the other end of a telephone call from Lansky. Like many of the events in Weinberg's colorful life, the incident had a complex beginning. It started when Weinberg was asked by a fellow swindler from Huntington, Long Island, if he knew anyone interested in buying a stolen $100,000 U.S. Treasury note. Weinberg tipped his FBI contact, Special Agent Bill Roselli, who told him to play along with the deal. One event followed another, and several months later, Weinberg found himself on the Caribbean island of St. Martin. He had taken Lady Diane with him for the sun, and they stayed at the St. Martin Isle Casino and Hotel, which was owned by an aging wealthy American named Alan Goberman. Goberman was afflicted with the naive idea that anyone with enough money could own a casino without taking in the mob as a partner. He was being stolen blind and was deeply in debt. He was also smitten by Lady Diane, and rushed her with flowers, gifts, and unswerving attention. Lady Diane was cordial but reserved, a posture that merely increased Goberman's wheezing ardor. Weinberg was in his usual pose as Lady Diane's business advisor, so Goberman approached him for advice on how to thaw her reserve. "She really likes you, Alan," Weinberg confided. "But she thinks you're only after her money." Appalled that Lady Diane had him pegged as a fortune hunter, Goberman decided upon a spectacular demonstration of selflessness. He gave Lady Diane the hotel and casino, and she in turn passed the gift to Weinberg. Weinberg beelined to the books and quickly discovered that Goberman's gift was not as magnanimous as it appeared. The operation was deeply in debt. Still, he thought, it was nice to own a hotel and casino, and it might make a great prop for a swindle until the creditors snapped it away. A few days later, Weinberg got a telephone call from Miami. The caller identified himself as Meyer Lansky, and mentioned enough about some of Weinberg's underworld friends to convince him that he was indeed talking to the withered mob financial wizard. Weinberg was advised by Lansky that he and his associates now owned the hotel, and that Weinberg would be seeing a visitor from Las Vegas in a few days. 2 days later, an obvious hoodlum entered Weinberg's hotel office. "Are you Weinberg, the owner?" he asked. "Yeah," Weinberg gulped. "Let me see the stock certificates," ordered the hood. Weinberg, his hands shaking, pushed them over the desk. The hoodlum ripped them up and threw them on the floor. "Now you ain't the owner no more," he said. Such was Weinberg's first brush with the legendary Meyer Lansky. Weinberg's hasty retreat from St. Martin typifies his attitude toward the heavy hitters in organized crime. He has deep respect for them. "Con men don't carry guns," he explained. "We ain't out to hurt anybody, just to take some money. But when you talk about organized crime, you're talking about people who'd as soon whack you as look at you. I don't play in that league. If they need a favor from me, they got it. I always want them to have good thoughts about me." The second Abscam-related event came when Weinberg and Lady Diane were homeward bound from Europe in the first-class section of a Pan-American jetliner. They ascended to the lounge for dinner and were seated at a table with an elderly, sophisticated Arab who introduced himself as Kambir Abdul Rahman of Beirut and Nice. He was a delightful, obviously wealthy old gentleman, and Weinberg warmed to him at once. He was staying at the Plaza in New York, and Weinberg insisted that he and Lady Diane drive him to his hotel in their chauffeured limousine. During the ride, the Arab told Weinberg that his wife had given him an order to bring home American towels. Weinberg, a true expert on where to buy the best, insisted that the Arab allow his chauffeur to pick him up at the hotel the next morning and take him to Fortunoff's on Long Island, whose selection of towels was both varied and reasonable. It was done. A few days later, Weinberg and Lady Diane accompanied the Arab back to Kennedy Airport in their limousine. Trailing behind were two more limousines hired by Weinberg to carry the Arab's newly bought towels.
Weinberg's impulsive generosity toward his new Arab friend was not unusual.
He is a proud crook, and his craft is swindling. But he's capable of warm personal relationships, occasional honest dealings, and even a rough form of loyalty toward people that he decides are stand-up guys. Just 1 year later, Weinberg and the FBI chose the name Kambir Abdul Rahman for one of the two mythical Arab sheikhs that they used in Abscam. The single event that finally made Abscam possible, however, did not occur until 1977. It was then that the law finally caught up with Mel Weinberg. For years, Weinberg had never been particularly concerned about the law. Advanced fee schemes were deemed civil cases, and when Marx complained, they were usually referred by law enforcement to the Better Business Bureau. But times were changing. The post-Watergate FBI had dropped its preoccupation with stolen cars and bank robberies, and had begun to concentrate on organized and white-collar crime. Weinberg was too busy making money to read the handwriting on the wall of London investors. The first hint came from the office of the New York State Attorney General in July 1976. A deputy attorney general wrote Weinberg at London investors demanding to know exactly what Weinberg had done to earn the advanced fee he had scammed from an irate New Jersey real estate broker. Surmising that the attorney general's office was staffed by political hacks who wanted to do as little work as possible, Weinberg wrote a long, devious answer. The matter was dropped. The earlier Schlag case, on the other hand, carried a hint of trouble almost from its start. It began routinely enough when a steerer directed Schlag to Weinberg for a loan. The Pittsburgh real estate man needed $1.9 million to buy a Pennsylvania dairy farm. Weinberg checked out the package and wrote Schlag in August of 1975, telling him that the advance fee for appraisal and processing the loan would be $3,564. He advised Schlag that after the loan package was sent to Europe, there would be a 30-to-45-day waiting period before the bank made a decision. Schlag sent the check on September 10, 1975, stating that he understood from Weinberg's letter that he would have a firm loan commitment from the bank within 15 days. Weinberg promptly replied that the original waiting period still stood. At the end of September, he asked Schlag for a financial statement and other information. 2 weeks later, Schlag asked for a copy of the proposal Weinberg had sent to the offshore bank in London. It was unusual for a mark to ask for a copy of the loan proposal. Weinberg simply ignored Schlag's letter. But by November 21st, Schlag started to threaten. He complained he still hadn't gotten a copy of the proposal and expressed the hope that the loan would come through immediately. If it didn't, he added, I will find it necessary to establish a firm and complete investigation as to the reasons for this refusal. But Schlag was still hoping. He concluded with the wish that we may always be the best of friends now and in the future. Weinberg had been giving Schlag the standard stall treatment, but Schlag was not reacting like a standard mark. Weinberg decided to throw a scare into Schlag, and then quickly hold out another carrot. On December 9, 1975, he wrote Schlag indignantly that the whole process had been delayed because his investigation had revealed that Schlag had given him a false financial statement and his staff had to rework the entire loan application before sending it to Europe. He said that if Schlag kept up his harassment, He would drop the entire application and sue Schlag for the extra expense to London investors caused by his falsification of a financial statement. The letter to Schlag reflected Weinberg's firm belief that Schlag's eagerness for the loan would overcome his suspicions and the threat to sue him would shut him up. The carrot came the next day, and another letter to Schlag by Weinberg. In this letter, he merely apologized for the delay, blaming some unnamed errors in the application that had to be rectified. He said that the package was now in front of the bank's board of directors and we should have an answer shortly. Early in January 1976, he again wrote Schlag telling him, "You will also have a definite yes or no answer regarding the approval of your loan no later than February 15, 1976. But Schlag had already turned the matter over to his lawyers. And when the bank letter came declining Schlag's loan, they turned the case over to the Pittsburgh office of the FBI. Later that year, after seizing the files of London investors, FBI agents emerged with more of Weinberg's current scam. A federal grand jury in Pittsburgh indicted him in February 1977 for wire fraud, mail fraud, and conspiracy. Worse still, Weinberg learned, the federal government had an arrest warrant out for Lady Diane. He moved Diane to an apartment complex in a large southern city that was used by organized crime as a hideaway. Favors done for the wise guys were favors returned. Diane, totally unaware of what was happening, grudgingly accepted Weinberg's excuse that she was being kept temporarily in seclusion for business reasons. But time was running out. His lawyer, Vince Cootie, had powerful political connections, but they didn't extend to the federal government. Weinberg's wife stood by him loyally through these months, mothering his bruised ego and optimistically assuring him that everything would turn out all right. But it was almost impossible to make a living with the government looking over his shoulder, and he sensed that each day the FBI was getting closer and closer to finding Diane. For the first time in his life, Weinberg knew that there was no way out. Nobody could be bought. No political connection could fix things. Nobody could be conned. He had no place to hide. Late in the summer of 1977, Weinberg called some of his old contacts in the FBI. He would surrender Lady Diane. She had never known, he explained, that he was using her as part of a swindle. Weinberg then did something he had never done before. He begged. "When I give Lady Diane to you," he pleaded, "treat her like a lady." He called Diane and asked her to meet him in Florida. He told her what he really was and what had happened to the two of them. She was shocked, angry, and when she realized the full import of what he was telling her, terrified. She began sobbing. Weinberg gently took her into his arms and softly said, "Don't cry, babe. I'll make everything all right." On October 7th, 1977, Mel Weinberg stood before a federal judge in Pittsburgh and pleaded guilty. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He had agreed to the plea arrangement after federal prosecutors had privately agreed to drop all charges against Lady Diane. Tape 6. Weinberg. "The way I got caught was, I gotta explain. They wanted me the worst way. I was getting too big. I was hurting a lot of people, and I stepped on a couple of politicians in Pittsburgh. So Pittsburgh came after me. It was hard for them to prove, because I never really gave a commitment by mail. If I wanted to give a person a commitment letter, I'd send it by plane. That way you don't violate the law on mail fraud. Eastern Airlines has a plane that delivers, and it would cost you $37 from Florida to New York, or even the West Coast. That's the way I sent it. When we used to get our certificates of deposit that got printed up for us in Puerto Rico or overseas, we always had them sent by plane. But my thing was to get the girl off, because I did her wrong. You can only be so much of a heel in this world. So my deal was that all charges were dropped against her, and I would cop a plea. They grabbed it, because they knew if I fought him in court, I'd beat him. You gotta remember that half the people that brought in these loans was lawyers. The feds have cracked down quite a bit on swindlers. Guys in the business now have to be more careful. But the feds will never knock us out of the box. I know one con man right now. He's in jail for pulling a sting. He's running a swindle right from the jail. He's selling bulletproof cars to the Arabs, and he's got guys on the outside backing him up. He's got $300,000 on deposit with his attorney right now. That's what I mean. No matter what the government does, as long as there's a sucker, there'll be a sting man. 5. An artful deal. I've always depended on my mouth to keep me out of trouble. I'm not an extra tough guy. I can handle myself. But I found out with a mouth, you can do more. Mel Weinberg. Gusting rain pelted the windows of the Midtown Manhattan building housing the offices of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It was mid-spring 1977. Nearly 6 months before Mel Weinberg would admit to fraud in a Pennsylvania federal court, and supervising agent John Good sat hunched in deep concentration over his desk. A sandy-haired man with blue eyes that always seemed tired, Good was part of a new breed that was slowly, inexorably assuming control of the FBI. During the long reign of J. Edgar Hoover, power within the Bureau was almost exclusively a WASP perquisite. Masonic rings, tautly knotted ties, and unswerving devotion to the Bureau way as articulated by the director were essential to ambitious young agents. Times, however, were changing. Now it was the turn of the big city ethnics, particularly the Irish. They were the upwardly mobile sons of bricklayers, policemen, politicians, firemen, and mail carriers, and were largely the product of such Jesuit colleges as Fordham, St. Peter's, Fairfield, Boston College, Holy Cross. Honed in the discipline of Aristotelian logic, imbued with a sense of morality, possessed of both flexibility and imagination, they filled the Bureau's new ranks. Good was one of them. He was a native of the Bronx, lace-curtain Irish, a graduate of Fordham, the son of a retired FBI agent. In fact, one of six children, five of whom had worked for the Bureau. He was careful, methodical, totally dedicated to his work. But he disliked and frequently ignored the dress code, spent more time on the street than in the office, and was prone to use new approaches to old problems. This latter trait occasionally ran contrary to the book, the standard FBI way of doing things. He was, however, married to the Bureau. After 16 years on the job, he still found it exciting and rewarding. Hours didn't count, and his creative, energetic approach had churned an impressive wake as he apprenticed his way through FBI offices in Springfield, Illinois, Monterey, California, and El Paso, Texas. Now, after handling a series of special squads in the New York office, he was assistant to the supervising agent. Totally result-oriented, Good fit the classic corporate definition of a bottom-line man. It had been a long day, and Good sighed when he looked at the stack of paperwork teetering on the lip of his in-basket. He hated paperwork, and openly envied the brick agents who spent most of their time in the field. He glanced through the glass wall that marked off his small office from the sea of desks beyond. Most of the desks were deserted. He checked his watch. The stainless steel pulsar read 9 p.m. No wonder the office was empty. Where the hell had the hours gone? He pulled a memo from the top of the stack. It was interoffice from Pittsburgh, routinely sent to Good because it involved charges against someone from the New York area. The Bureau had been concentrating on white-collar crime, and Good was looking for informants, people involved in white-collar crime who could help make some criminal cases. He studied the heading on the memo he held in his hand. Subject: Melvin Weinberg. He read on. Arrested on Long Island on a warrant issued from Pittsburgh. A swindler specializing in advance fee scams. Has cooperated with FBI in the past. Willing to plead guilty and cooperate to protect his girlfriend. Good thoughtfully tapped his pencil against the memo. Before being chained to a desk by his own ambition, he had been expert on the selection and development of informants. It was a tricky business. Some promised miracles if only the FBI would give them a break. But they gave as little as possible. Others used their informant status as a license to commit new crimes. More than one good agent had blown his career because he had become too friendly with an informant to keep the relationship in clear perspective. The files revealed, however, that Weinberg had always produced in the past. He was obviously up to his neck in white-collar crime and had extensive contacts throughout the world. His base of operations was New York and Long Island. Why not give it a shot? Good scrawled a notation on the memo ordering Myron Fuller, one of his agents, to travel to Pittsburgh for an interview with Weinberg. Abscam was born at that precise moment. What would later become the most sordid scandal in congressional history, and the FBI's most redeeming investigation, was conceived as a scrawled note. The idea was still formless, a toss of the dice, targetless. The decision was so mundane that Good tossed the memo into his outbasket and dismissed it from his mind. Wounded congressmen and obfuscating defense lawyers would later thunder that Abscam had been created to ensnare members of the legislative branch. They would ascribe a potpourri of motives to the sinister plot. Some would charge that it was an attempt by the executive branch to regain the dominance over Congress lost in the debacle of the Nixon presidency. Others would say that it was a right-wing smear of liberal congressmen. The record reflects, however, that Abscam began as a simple exercise in catching crooks. The fact that it netted a U.S. senator and seven congressmen during the last 6 months of its 2-year existence is merely validation of the widely held premise that if you set out to catch crooks, you will often catch congressmen. Good looked at the remaining pile of paperwork and decided to hell with it. Tomorrow was another day. He tugged at the hated necktie, shrugged on his sports jacket, bid goodnight to the duty agent, and walked out to the elevator. He still had a 75-minute drive along the dark, rain-slicked Long Island Expressway to his home in East Islip. His wife and children would probably be in bed. He'd make a sandwich, catch the 11 o'clock news, and crash dive. He was really bushed. A few days later, Agent Fuller called Good from Pittsburgh to report that Weinberg was anxious to deal. He wanted nothing for himself, just legal absolution for a woman he called Lady Diane. As matters stood, the case against her wasn't very strong. Good, for his part, wasn't taking any chances. "Tell Weinberg we'll do what we can for her if he delivers," he told Fuller. "But let him know that we don't produce unless he delivers first. This guy's a professional swindler, and the Bureau isn't going to wind up as one of his marks." Fuller called back later. Weinberg would cooperate. Free on bail, Weinberg returned to Long Island. Good assigned Fuller and Agent Jack McCarthy of the Bureau's Suffolk County office to handle him on a day-to-day basis. Good gave them a general target at which to point Weinberg. The Bureau, he said, was interested in any kind of white-collar fraud. He ticked off some of the possibilities. Stolen art, forged or stolen securities, gold certificates and certificates of deposit, advanced fee scams, counterfeit money, bankruptcy bust-outs. It was a long list, but certainly familiar terrain to Weinberg. The assignment of McCarthy and Fuller to Weinberg had mixed results. Both men were solid, experienced agents, and their work with Weinberg over the next year would result in major fraud arrests and provide a solid foundation for the later phases of Abscam. But there are very few people in this world who can control Mel Weinberg and make him like it. He tolerated Fuller, but quickly grew to dislike McCarthy. It was largely a matter of personality and style. A pleasant, gray-haired man, McCarthy exuded the Calvinistic attitudes peculiar to some Irish Catholics. He had spent a lifetime fighting crooks, compromises, and corruption. No matter what Weinberg professed, he was still a crook as far as McCarthy was concerned, and had to be watched carefully. Both McCarthy and Fuller, who was less rigid, were bookmen. There was the FBI way and the wrong way. They were careful, conservative, cautious. Neither would have made it as a swindler in the outside world. Weinberg, by contrast, was a highly volatile informant, disliking orders and preferring to work alone. His expensive and flamboyant style was anathema to his supervisors. Further, McCarthy and Fuller quickly saw that he was shifty and quick-witted, that his stock in trade was the lie, the stall, the convincing half-truth. They recognized that he was egotistical, thrived on admiration, despised rules, scorned conventional morality, and regarded crookdom as a proud and much maligned profession. Weinberg, for his part, also saw nothing incompatible about working for the FBI and making a quick buck on the side. The two agents and Weinberg launched the project with a talk alongside the swimming pool at Weinberg's Central Islip home in the early summer of 1977. They finally decided to have Weinberg focus most of his attention on two local swindlers with whom he had worked in the past. The selected targets were Fred Proe, a New York front-end scammer who had once owned his own offshore bank, and Joe Trocchio, a veteran hoodlum with ties to organized crime who occasionally provided muscle for Proe's operation. Trocchio, the more important and dangerous of the two, was awaiting trial in neighboring Nassau County on charges of peddling $150,000 in stolen Swiss traveler's checks. Four potential witnesses in the case had already been murdered. Weinberg regarded Proe as just another swindler, but he was worried about working on Trocchio. "He has heavy friends, the kind of people I don't like to cross," Weinberg explained. But the two agents were insistent. "I figured if I had to do it to get Diane off the hook, I'd just have to do it," said Weinberg. "When you're working for the government, they don't take a pound of flesh, they take a ton." Each of the agents had his own idea about how Weinberg should begin, but the cocky swindler was determined to do it his own way. He would pretend to go back into the advanced fee business, using the European bank ruse. But he proposed adding a new gimmick. "I've been reading the papers about all this OPEC shit," said Weinberg. "Everybody thinks all Arabs are loaded with dough. Just before I got locked up, I started telling Marks that I had a couple of Arab guys with dough to invest. People were busting down my doors to give me packages. I'm going to push that with these guys." The agents agreed, and the Arab aspect was added to the emerging abscam scenario. When the two agents left for home after that first meeting, Weinberg remained at the pool, puffing on his cigar and thinking. McCarthy and Fuller obviously didn't trust him. He could understand their caution, but it rankled. Although both agents were polite and interested, he could sense their disdain. He felt like a bug under a microscope. He could handle that. He could easily control the relationship by convincing the agents that his ideas were their ideas. But if they didn't trust him now, why should they trust any future information that he might give them? And if this were the case, how would he ever protect Diane? He ambled into the house and rummaged through boxes until he found an old Norelco tape recorder with a telephone attachment. He was resolved to tape every key conversation in the investigation. Only in this way, he was convinced, would he be able to prove that he was telling the truth. This decision, conceived in equal parts by distrust and desperation, was the genesis of the constant tape recording that became Abscam's trademark. A few days later, Weinberg had his sting going strong and his Norelco working overtime. One of his first moves was to reach Trocchio, the 63-year-old tough guy. Both men talked about their impending trials. Both hoped that they would get probation, and both agreed that now, more than ever, they needed to make plenty of money quickly. Weinberg then set the hook. "Trocchio, and I would like you to meet with them, business acquaintances. Maybe we could do something and meet easily." Weinberg. "Yeah, we could do something. In fact, I got something very good cooking right now." Trocchio. "Oh, yeah?" Weinberg. "Yeah, I got, remember that friend of mine, that Arab I was dealing with?" Trocchio. "Yeah?" Weinberg. How, well, he sent some people into town because he heard I was in trouble and may need some bread. Trocchio. Weinberg. For investments. Trocchio. Hey, I got two deals. I got one deal, which I'll tell you that'll make your head spin around. One of Trocchio's deals involved a Long Island firm known as Brookhaven Mortgages. The firm had its offices in the same building on Route 110 that had housed Weinberg's London investors, now defunct. Trocchio told Weinberg that he and Fred Proe were using forged securities to buy into the firm. They would then use Brookhaven to wash money for two of New York's largest crime families. Eventually, they would loot its assets. Weinberg told Fuller and McCarthy about Trocchio's plans for Brookhaven. He backed it up with the tapes. They were impressed. Within a few days, Weinberg introduced Fuller to Trocchio and Fred Proe as one of his business associates. After that, the FBI was able to monitor step-by-step the attempted takeover of Brookhaven. Trocchio, meanwhile, offered to supply Weinberg with counterfeit $50 bills and certified checks drawn on a large New York bank. Weinberg asked for samples, and Trocchio directed him to come to his house in rural Manorville, Long Island, that night. Scene. It is a dark, moonless night. Weinberg cruises his Lincoln slowly down a country road. He stops in front of a large house, flanked by a junkyard. A man stands in front of the house, Joe Trocchio. The two men talk softly. "The samples are in an envelope," says Trocchio. "The envelope is fastened to the inside wall of the rabbit hutch behind the house. Go back and get it." Weinberg walks to the rear of the house, thinking that Trocchio is clever enough not actually to handle the counterfeit samples, just in case Weinberg is part of a police sting. He finds the hutch, opens the wire gate, and reaches in for the envelope. Something chomps down on his hand, and he shouts in pain and surprise. Peering into the hutch, he sees a very large rabbit. "You son of a bitchin' bastard," he growls as he boots the rabbit out of the hutch. The rabbit hops away, and Weinberg pockets the envelope. He goes out front to Trocchio and complains. "You schmuck! You didn't tell me you had a fucking guard rabbit back there." Trocchio runs off in frantic pursuit of what he describes as his prize rabbit. "Prize my ass," Weinberg mutters as he drives away. Though Weinberg professes to like animals, there are only two types that he really has use for. Those that are edible, or respectful, or both. He likes tail-wagging dogs, tolerates farm stock, ignores birds, and has no use for the rest of the animal kingdom. "Everybody wants to save tigers and alligators," he complains. "Those bastards eat you if you give them the chance. Who wants them? As far as I'm concerned, if you can't eat it, kill it." It was another kind of killing, however, that Trocchio discussed with Weinberg several days later. His pal Fred Proe, he said, was outraged and embarrassed. Proe the swindler had been swindled by a supposed mark from Cleveland named Lucio. Proe wanted a mob hitman to murder Lucio and get his money back. He had asked Trocchio to make the arrangements, but Trocchio had no connections in the Midwest. Patiently, Weinberg extracted the details from Trocchio. Proe, who ran his front-end scam from a plush Manhattan office, had arranged to take a loan from Lucio and his group on some properties that Proe supposedly owned. His ownership papers were actually forgeries. He agreed to pay the Lucio group $30,000 in advance fees for a loan of several million on the imaginary properties. When the time came to pay Lucio's fees, however, the only money Proe had on hand was an out-of-town check for $110,000 that he had just gotten on another deal. It would take up to 10 days for his bank to clear the check and give him the cash. Lucio's lawyer said that he could get it cleared at his own bank in 48 hours. He said he would deduct Lucio's $30,000 and deliver the $80,000 balance in cash to Pro's office. Pro agreed. But Lucio and his friends banked the check in Cleveland and kept all the money. "Proe wasn't only angry over being swindled," said Trocchio. "Lucio was telling everyone in Cleveland how he had scammed Proe, and word was drifting back to New York. Lucio had no respect. Could Weinberg have him whacked out? Weinberg pondered a moment and said that he knew a Midwest contract killer named Jim Paget, J.P. for short. Weinberg volunteered to contact Paget. Disguising his voice, Weinberg called back Trocchio and identified himself as Jim Paget. He said that the price of the hit would be $10,000, $5,000 in advance, and the balance when Lucio was killed. Trocchio agreed to send the money to J.P. through Weinberg. Tape 7. Weinberg. I go to Trocchio's house to collect the money, and the bum only gives me $2,500 in advance instead of the $5,000. He gives a drawing of the hotel this guy owns, what his car looks like, where he eats, where he hangs out. Everything a killer needs. I took the $2,500 and call back Trocchio a week later and tell him J.P. won't do nothing till he gets the other $2,500. Trocchio gets pissed and says, I'll send out a hit on him. I say, go ahead. Then I called Fred Pro and told him I was J.P. I said, Pro, you didn't keep your promise. You promised $5,000 in advance and $5,000 afterward. I only got $2,500. Pro swore up and down that he'd given Trocchio $10,000 for me. Trocchio was cheating Pro and holding out on me. That's the kind of people these are. There's no honesty anymore. McCarthy and Fuller were concerned that Trocchio might later turn to another hitman. They arranged for the FBI's Cleveland office to tell Lucio he was a murder target and that Pro was behind the plot. Lucio immediately called Pro and told him that the federal government had warned him about the contract on his life. Pro called Trocchio in a panic, and Trocchio asked Weinberg to meet him again at his house. When Weinberg arrived, Trocchio confided, Mel, we got a leak. The FBI told Lucio there's a contract on him. Can we trust J.P.? Absolutely, lied Weinberg. J.P.'s a mob hitter. He'd never talk to the feds. Maybe there's a tap on Pro's phone or yours. Maybe they found out that way. Weinberg persuaded Trocchio that his tap theory was true. Trocchio was plainly worried. Tell J.P. he doesn't have to kill him, okay? Said Trocchio. We still want our money back. But it's okay if J.P. just breaks his legs a little. Weeks passed. Trocchio asked Weinberg whether J.P. had made any progress. Weinberg shook his head. He's pissed, he said. He said you guys held out on his money. He wants nothing more to do with you. I ain't gonna push him either. I'm not getting anything out of this, and he'd whack me out in a minute if he gets mad at me. Trocchio shrugged his acceptance of the inevitable and dropped the subject. Trocchio's loyalty to Fred Pro was short-lived. Less than a week after he and Weinberg had their final discussion about J.P., Trocchio called with another proposition. Pro was doing so well with his front-end scams, Trocchio complained, that he was acting like a big shot. Trocchio wanted Weinberg to send a muscle man to Pro's office and slap him around a little bit. The hood was to tell Pro that he'd been sent by Trocchio. Trocchio said he could walk in the day after and take over Pro's operation, splitting it with Weinberg. McCarthy and Fuller checked with John Good. What part, they asked, should the Bureau play in this? Good assigned Ernie Haridopoulos, a tall, broad-shouldered FBI agent, to act as Weinberg's professional slugger. After several meetings with Weinberg and Trocchio, Haridopoulos visited Pro's New York office. Weinberg had urged the FBI to go along with Trocchio's scheme and let Haridopoulos work over Pro. He's a sissy, Weinberg advised. One shot to the gut and he'll turn in everyone he knows. But word came back down the chain of command that Good wanted no rough stuff. Haridopoulos was to lean on Pro very lightly. The agent told Pro when he arrived at his office that he had come to take over the business for Trocchio. Pro, awed by the agent's size, but reassured by his polite approach, said that he wouldn't allow Haridopoulos to take over the business, but he could work for Pro. While the agent pretended to consider the offer, Pro showed him where he kept all of his secret office records. Haridopoulos declined the job offer and left. A week later, FBI agents, armed with search warrants, raided Pro's office. Unerringly, they went to the hiding places where he kept his packages. The swindler was stunned by the Bureau's efficiency, totally unaware that Haradopoulos, the friendly thug, had given the agents a detailed map of where they should look. Within 3 months, Weinberg had given the Bureau solid cases against both Trocchio and Pro. As fishermen know, once a net is cast, there's no controlling the quantity or quality of what it traps. Weinberg, once back in action, served up a veritable smorgasbord of potential fraud cases for the FBI. Good, by now, had been given his own FBI command, the 23-agent Suffolk office. He had already launched some of his best agents on a successful investigation of the country's billion-dollar sewer scandal. But he wanted to keep the pressure on white-collar crime. Through McCarthy, Good relayed a request to Weinberg. Would he follow through on the cases that he was churning up? Weinberg agreed to work if the FBI paid his expenses. Good faced an immediate problem. If the federal government indicted Pro and Trocchio, it would have to surface Weinberg as a witness. This would blow Weinberg's cover and kill any chance he might have of developing the other cases. Tom Puccio, director of the Eastern District Federal Strike Force, agreed to hold off indictments until the other cases were completed. Neither he nor Good could know that these were the first of a long series of indictments that would have to be stalled as Abscam widened and probed the innards of crime and corruption. Abscam had no name at this point. Good put Weinberg on a limited expense account. The Bureau had allocated $32,000 to conduct the white-collar crime sting. The FBI supervisor figured that if he kept expenses down, he could get at least 8 months out of the project. Bureau cost accountants had not reckoned on Mel Weinberg, however. He had spent as much as $32,000 in a single week when London Investors was in its prime. He had done it all for the illusion. He had spent without a moment's thought or hesitation. No vouchers or receipts required. He saw no reason why he should operate any differently as an agent of the richest, most powerful nation in the world. Eventually, he prevailed. 2 years later, the government's bill for Abscam would total well over $500,000. But that was later. Weinberg complained to McCarthy that he was sick of operating out of his house. Besides, he said, it was dangerous for Marie and their son. If the government wanted him to act like a big swindler, he would need a big office, expensive furniture, secretaries, and at least one telex. He said that he was embarrassed using his own tape recorder and buying his own tapes. He was also putting too much mileage on his Lincoln. It was time, he complained, for the government to pony up. McCarthy relayed Weinberg's demands to Good. "This guy's got to be out of his mind," Good moaned. "He wants to spend $30,000 just for office furniture. We can't justify that kind of outlay." Good, however, got in a supply of tapes and second-hand recorders. Weinberg promptly complained that the recorders were old and faulty. He had a point. "In the beginning, this investigation didn't have a very high priority," Good concedes. "We were using junk." Confronting Weinberg, McCarthy told him that Good was exploring possibilities for an office. He ordered Weinberg to keep working with the available equipment, vetoed his other spending ideas, and told him to hold down his expenses. Weinberg was totally unfamiliar with the federal budgeting process. He decided that McCarthy was cheapskating the project to win favor with his bosses. He fixed on the idea, and his resentment against McCarthy grew stronger. McCarthy's personal frugality served to confirm Weinberg's impression. Nevertheless, Weinberg kept working. During the years that he had operated as a bona fide swindler, Weinberg had derived enormous satisfaction at outwitting his marks. He found it even more rewarding to beat his fellow swindlers. "It was sort of like the Super Bowl of scam," he explained. "I was playing against the best, and I was winning." Although Weinberg dangled his bogus Arab investors at potential targets, he continued to use the mythical European bank contacts that had been his stock in trade with Swiss Bank Associates and London Investors. Lady Diane, still his mistress, was no longer part of the scam. But it still worked. Weinberg's home phone rang constantly. A blind stock swindler from Manhattan was offering forged bank certificates. A New York-Miami group had an offshore bank in Antigua and was willing to supply millions in certificates of deposit for 8% of their face value. Weinberg fielded them all. In some instances, where targets could be nailed and indicted and tried without surfacing Weinberg, the FBI made arrests. The other cases were quietly shelved for later action. Weinberg knew that when Abscam ended and he took the stand as a witness, his days as a con man would be over. He would never be trusted again by his underworld contacts, the operators of offshore banks, or the steerers who were vital to any economy-sized swindle. This was, he knew, his own last hurrah. So he used every device, ruse, and illusion he had learned over the years to fashion the sting into a lasting monument. One of these devices was careful attention to detail, the casual conversation gambits, for instance, that lent an aura of reality to the good swindle. In fact, Weinberg had no real ties with European banks. But two early tape conversations with a suspected swindler show how he could create the illusion that he was in constant contact with those banks. First day tape. Weinberg. We're going to have to make that Monday or Tuesday. I'm sorry to disappoint you. Let me explain to you why. Because right now the books are ready to close over there in Europe. You know, there's a 5-hour time difference. Swindler. Okay. Tape several days later. Weinberg. I heard from Europe again this morning. Swindler. Yeah? Weinberg. Fucking guys. They wake you up in the morning, these cocksuckers. Swindler. Yeah, huh? Weinberg. Well, you know, it's a 6-hour difference. Swindler. I know. Weinberg. And these fucks call you at 9 a.m. their time. You know what time that is here? Swindler. Yeah. In stressing the time difference between Europe and Long Island, Weinberg was using a conversational device to strengthen the illusion that he was in contact with the European banks. The conversational snatches are also a classic example of the stall. Weinberg was promising the swindler funds from Europe that he never intended to deliver, and he was using the time difference as an excuse for the delay. Late in 1977, FBI agent Tom McShane contacted Weinberg with an urgent problem. He explained that a rotund thief named Dominic Cassarelli was trying to peddle stolen paintings valued at more than $1 million. The paintings had been snatched several years before by hoodlums tied to organized crime. Cassarelli and his accomplices had then stolen the paintings from the original thieves. The problem, McShane explained, was that Cassarelli was too cautious to be approached by the FBI. The Bureau needed someone whom Cassarelli would trust, so that the FBI could flush out the paintings and arrest the entire gang. Weinberg called Cassarelli and introduced himself as the agent for a rich Texan who wanted to buy stolen art with no questions asked. Weinberg said that he didn't expect Cassarelli to trust a stranger on a delicate matter like this. He suggested that Cassarelli call mobster Anthony Tony Ducks Corallo, an old glass-clinking associate of Weinberg's at Orlando's restaurant in Huntington. "Don't tell Ducks what it's all about," Weinberg warned Cassarelli. "Just ask him what he knows about me and whether I can be trusted. He'll vouch for me. If you're satisfied, call me back and we'll talk some more." Weinberg was following standard underworld protocol when he gave Cassarelli the name of Tony Ducks as a reference. It's the usual way in which members of the underworld, meeting for the first time, establish that neither is an undercover law enforcement agent. The practice is called vouching. Weinberg sat and waited. A week later, Cassarelli called back. He arranged to meet Weinberg at a bar in upstate Ellenville, New York. Weinberg got to the appointment early and learned to his delight that he knew the bartender, a bookmaker who used to work in the city, and the bartender's waitress girlfriend. When Cassarelli finally arrived, suspicious that the meeting was a trap set by either the mob or the law, the bartender and waitress enthusiastically vouched for Weinberg. Weeks dragged by as Cassarelli and Weinberg exchanged phone calls and haggled price. Cassarelli and his friends wanted $1 million for the art. Weinberg set a maximum of $750,000 and refused to budge. Since the FBI never intended to pay over any money, the price was academic. But Weinberg argued that he would create suspicion if he didn't try to get the stolen paintings at the cheapest price possible. Casarelli finally agreed to Weinberg's terms and said that his group was ready to deal. They wanted to make the switch, paintings for cash in a downtown hotel, Weinberg recalls. I said no way. I'm not walking into no hotel with $750,000. I'm not going anywhere where there's only one door out. If anything goes wrong, I get killed. I'm not stupid. Weinberg was serious. Even with FBI protection, he was afraid he could get involved in a hotel room firefight with no way out. His hesitation further eased Casarelli's doubts. If Weinberg had been an undercover cop, he wouldn't balk at the hotel room meeting. Weinberg made Casarelli a counterproposal. He would meet Casarelli at a New York City area airport and fly him in Weinberg's private plane to any other airport which Casarelli would designate after they were in the air. That way, Weinberg explained, neither he nor the art expert he was bringing with him would know in advance the location of the stolen paintings. Once they landed, Weinberg said, his art expert would authenticate the paintings, and the exchange would take place. The idea of an airport exchange had not been mentioned to the FBI by Weinberg before he proposed it to Casarelli. Unsurprisingly, it came as a shock to McShane, and then to Good when McShane told him about it. The logistical problems posed by such a complicated exchange were enormous. When McShane mentioned this to Weinberg, the ebullient swindler dismissed the complaint with an airy wave of his cigar and chortled, "You guys are paid to handle details." For the entire next week, Good switched his attention from the high-priority sewer probe to plans for the unusual exchange. The FBI rented a 4-passenger plane to be flown by a bureau pilot. The passengers would be McShane, who was to play the art expert, Weinberg and Casarelli, or anyone he might designate. 2 smaller planes were rented as chase planes and staffed with FBI pilots and agents. Good groaned as he calculated the cost of Weinberg's air flotilla. Casarelli told Weinberg that the exchange would be at an undisclosed upstate airport on a Friday night early in February 1978. He ordered Weinberg to fly first to Stewart Air Base in upstate Newburgh, New York, to pick him up. Then he would direct Weinberg's pilot to the final rendezvous once Weinberg's plane was again in the air. The FBI gave Weinberg a suitcase. Inside were bundles of simulated money. A few real bills were at the top and bottom of each bundle. Between them were bill-sized pieces of paper cut from phone books. Weinberg was warned not to let Casarelli look at the bundles too closely after they picked him up for the final flight from Stewart. Weinberg's plane flew through the cold, moonlit night from LaGuardia Airport to Stewart, landed and taxied to the small terminal. Weinberg peered expectantly out the window for Casarelli. Then he saw him. "He must have weighed 320 pounds, and he was real short," said Weinberg. "He looked like a bowling ball." He comes waddling out to the plane and gets in. He plops into the seat and nearly breaks the plane. He's hanging over the seat on both sides. "I never thought we'd get back off the ground." But fly they did. Once in the air, Casarelli pulled out a road map and pointed to a small airport about 50 miles away. "Here's where we're going," he wheezed. "Now let me see the dough." Weinberg unlocked the suitcase, gave him a brief look, and snapped it shut again. "I want to count it," argued Casarelli. "Not till we land," snapped Weinberg. "If you shift in your seat, you'll tip the plane over." The pilot agreed with Weinberg. A novice at flying in small planes, Casarelli gulped, blanched, and nervously tried to balance himself in the center of his seat. The pilot broke the tense silence, asking if he could radio the designated airport for landing instructions. Casarelli, trying to keep as still as possible, gave him a sick nod. The pilot's call to the airport was heard by the 2 chase planes flying behind. While the pilot of Weinberg's plane purposely wasted time flying in wide circles over the Hudson River Valley, the 2 chase planes flew directly to an airport near the community of Peekskill and landed. The planes parked near the taxiway, and the agents disembarked and pretended to busy themselves checking the wheels and tying the planes down. Weinberg's plane landed, and the fat man pulled out a hand radio and spoke to his accomplice, who was waiting by the side of a van several hundred feet away. "We're here," said Casarelli. "Do they have the money?" his accomplice radioed back. "Yeah, but they won't let me count it," complained Casarelli. "Screw it," said the other man. "We don't have time. Send the art guy down here to look at the merchandise and stick to that money like glue." McShane walked toward the van, and Casarelli stood next to Weinberg on the runway. As soon as McShane signaled, the FBI agents planned to rush both Casarelli and his associate. Earlier they had warned Weinberg to get as far away as possible from Casarelli in case there was gunfire when the agents made their rush. Now Weinberg tried unobtrusively to move sideways, putting distance between the hefty Casarelli and himself. But the fat man stayed glued to him. In desperation, Weinberg whirled on Casarelli and shouted, "Will you get the fuck away from me? You got body odor so bad I can't stand it." But the bulk wouldn't budge. "Up yours, Mac," he snarled. "I stay with the bread." Weinberg again shifted sideways. His unwanted companion shifted with him, moving even closer. From the corner of his eye, Weinberg saw McShane's signal from the side of the van. The art was authentic. The FBI agents started their rush. Weinberg, frantic, threw himself to the ground and covered his head with his arms, his eyes screwed shut. Seconds later, he heard a rustling sound, and the click of what sounded like handcuffs snapping shut. He looked up into the faces of several grinning FBI agents. Other agents were already 30 feet away, escorting the prisoners to a waiting car. Weinberg got to his feet, collecting his dignity as he slapped puffs of runway dust from his overcoat. "Fuck you, too," he growled at the agents as he turned and trudged toward the car. "Hey, Weinberg," called one of the agents. "Where did you get the idea for the airplane exchange?" "Watching TV," answered Weinberg. He was telling the truth. Weinberg had more than one reason to feel relieved. Good had kept his promise. No charges had been filed against Diane, and a Pittsburgh judge had suspended his own 3-year jail sentence and placed him on probation. While he waited for McShane to finish the paperwork on the arrests in the office of the local United States commissioner, Weinberg got more good news. The insurance company that had issued policies on the stolen paintings was giving him a $10,000 reward for their recovery, and the Bureau promised a bonus. Maybe, Weinberg mused, he could make a living as a government crook. Tape 8. Weinberg, on vouching. If someone you meet is moving with the wise guys and you want to get close to him, you gotta come up with a name that he knows. Like you ask him if he's from Brooklyn. If he says he's from Brooklyn, give him the name of some wise guy from Brooklyn, like Sonny Francese, and tell him that Sonny's a friend of yours. That's called vouching. He figures if you're a friend of Sonny's, you must be okay, and you must be pretty heavy. Right away, he's your good friend. He can't do enough for you. In New York, almost every wise guy you meet says he used to work for Sonny. Sonny's got a lot of respect. If all of those wise guys really did work for Sonny, he would have had an army. But most vouching is pure bullshit. No way these big guys in the mob can remember all the people they've met over the years. But they don't want to say they don't know someone. That might make them look stupid, and no wise guy wants to look stupid. So vouching usually works whether you know a big mob guy or not. Weinberg on watching TV. It's nervous work being a con man. You spend a lot of time sitting in your hotel room just waiting. Most of the time you're waiting for the mark to bring the money. When you hear a knock on the door, you don't know what to expect. Maybe it's the mark with some friends and they've come to beat the shit out of you. When you hear the knock, you never know for sure. It's a very nervous time. I used to sit there waiting and biting my fingernails. After a while, I learned to turn on the TV. I don't care what I'm watching. Anything will do. Sports, news, soaps, westerns, commercials, I don't give a shit. I find it soothing. It relaxes me. Now, whenever I got nothing to do, I turn on the TV and just stare at it. It's a habit. I know a lot of con men are the same way. Sometimes, just watching TV, you learn something that can help with a con, so it's not a complete waste of time. I really enjoy 60 Minutes. Don't ask me why. Otherwise, I'll watch anything.
6. The Honey Pot. It was without a compeer among swindles. It was perfect. It was rounded, symmetrical, complete, colossal. Mark Twain. When they asked me to go work for the government, they built it up and made it sound great. After a week of working, I figured they were even bigger bullshit artists than me. Mel Weinberg. Mel Weinberg sat alone in a booth at the Blue Dawn Diner. He was on his second cigar and his third cup of coffee, and the waitress was throwing him dirty looks. He checked his watch again, tapped the case with his finger, and held it to his ear. It was still ticking. No question about it. FBI agent Jack McCarthy was a half hour late. Bored and irritated, he looked out the window at busy Veterans Memorial Highway. Cars and trucks bound for various Long Island communities whizzed by in both directions. The biting March wind kicked up swirls of dust, and tiny pieces of grit tattooed the steamy window pane. He took a sip of coffee. It was cold. If he asked for another cup, they'd probably charge him rent. He concentrated instead on skimming a copy of Newsday abandoned by an earlier customer. He opened the bulky newspaper and ran his eye over the upfront stories. Former Italian Premier Aldo Moro had been kidnapped, apparently by the Red Brigade. A Suffolk grand jury had indicted two officials of a local hospital for ripping off $1.8 million in insurance payments. Two other events were packaged on the next page. Investigators charged that South Korean President Park Chung-hee had helped plan his government's attempts to influence the U.S. Congress, and a former federal judge was being asked to look into corruption charges against Pennsylvania Congressman Daniel Flood. He wondered if his old buddy Squeaky from the Red Brigade was involved in the Morrow snatch. Probably. Squeaky was involved in all the big jobs. He nodded his head appreciatively at news of the hospital swindle. Very pretty. It was too bad they'd been caught. As for the hints of congressional corruption, so what? There was no point in running for office if you couldn't make a bundle afterward. Besides, the congressman would beat the rap. They always did. Weinberg looked up from the paper as McCarthy, red-faced from the wind and exertion, slid into the booth and apologized for being late. There'd been a major break in the sewer probe, he said, and he had just left the office and raced down Veterans to the diner. Weinberg was curious about the sewer case. Some of the contractors involved were friends from Orlando's restaurant. He asked a few questions, but McCarthy gave him carefully guarded answers. McCarthy's professional caution triggered the volatile mixture of impatience and resentment that had been working inside Weinberg for weeks. He let it all out. He'd been promised an office, good equipment, and expenses as part of the deal to follow up on leads that he had developed. He complained that he had no office, forcing him to meet hoodlums at his nearby home. This, he said, posed a potential danger to his family. He grumbled that most of the equipment was faulty, and that the only expense money he ever saw was an occasional $50 bill that he pried from McCarthy. Softly responding to Weinberg's angry words, McCarthy reminded him that he had just gotten a $10,000 reward for his part in recovering the stolen paintings. Weinberg snapped back that he was already spending some of the reward money on the government cases. He was still using his own tape recorder and tapes. He was making most of his phone calls from his home, and he was still racking up the mileage on his own car. Besides, he asked, how was he supposed to support his family? Weinberg was also bothered by things he didn't mention to McCarthy. His father had died the month before, February 21st, 1978, a sad event that focused his own sense of mortality. His blood pressure was bubbling, according to his doctor. He was paying Eastern Airlines a small fortune for his frequent flights back and forth from Florida, where he was keeping Diane in a trailer. Most of all, though, he was frustrated because he couldn't work with his accustomed style and flair. McCarthy promised to talk to John Good. He said he knew that Good had submitted plans to the Bureau for a much more ambitious program, using Weinberg as the fulcrum. If the Bureau approved Good's proposal, McCarthy hinted, Weinberg might be put on salary, plus better expenses. He warned, however, that the okay from Washington, if it ever came, might still take several months. It was the kind of hope that Weinberg had once used to stall his own marks, and he knew it. But he also knew that right now it was the only direction open to him. He seized the hope and embraced it. There's two things you gotta do if you want to do this right, he told McCarthy. Number one, you gotta beat them at their own game. The con game is one round robin. Each con man knows the next guy. They're in touch with each other. When you have a sucker on the line, you gotta keep calling him night and day. Never let him off the hook, because as soon as you forget to call, he'll go somewhere else, and the other guy'll grab him. Number two, you gotta set up a class sting. You gotta hire offices, limos, classy secretaries, something a little different like that. A plane would be great. A few days later, McCarthy called Weinberg. There was no news yet from Washington, but Good wanted to get a running head start on the project. He had talked a friendly real estate owner into loaning him space just vacated by a bank, on the ground floor of the Hopog building where the FBI had offices. Weinberg chuckled at the irony of the location, but he was elated. He remembers saying, "We're on our way." Well, almost on our way, Weinberg thought the next day as he surveyed the huge room that had once housed the bank. He had just learned that there was no furniture, no phones, and no money for them in the budget. He drove to the Huntington office of his lawyer, Vince Cootie, who had stored some of Weinberg's furniture from London investors after his arrest. Telling Cootie that he was back in the investment business, Weinberg brought the few remaining pieces of furniture back to his new office. There was only his desk, which he placed in the middle of the room, and three chairs, which he arranged around the desk. It looked like a small oasis of furniture in a vast desert of empty space. From home, he brought his cordless telephone and put it on the desk. The room still looked empty. Weinberg wasn't discouraged. He remembered the first days of London investors. No furniture, telephones on the floor, but customers fought their way in. Weinberg, McCarthy, and Myron Fuller huddled around the desk to devise a theme for the sting. OPEC and oil still dominated the headlines, and Weinberg's hint of ties with Arab investors over the past few months had brought the hustlers swarming. Weinberg suggested the idea of naming a specific Arab, and then agreed when the two agents proposed the idea back to him. He decided to use the name of the aging Arab millionaire he had befriended a year or so before on the flight back from Paris with Lady Diane. The original theme, quickly approved by Good, fleshed out over the following few months. Weinberg supplied most of the ideas, although Fuller, McCarthy, and Good all added touches before the sting was full-blown. The emphasis sometimes changed, but the basic version of the sting had Weinberg acting as the American agent of his old pal, millionaire Arab businessman Kambir Abdul Rahman. The spelling of Kambir was changed slightly several times. According to the scenario, Abdul, who supposedly resided in one of the Arab Emirates when he wasn't living in Switzerland, Beirut, or Cannes, was related to Arab royalty. Some targets of the scam were told that Abdul's money could not be loaned out at interest because of Islamic laws against usury. As a result, these marks were told, Abdul needed an unlimited supply of bogus certificates of deposit from offshore banks or forged certificates from legitimate banks. These certificates would be given by Abdul to his Muslim banks, and he would then be able to withdraw cash equal to the face amount of the certificates and quietly invest the cash at interest elsewhere. Other targets were merely told that Abdul wanted to invest as much of his millions in the U.S. as possible, because he felt it was only a matter of time before he would have to flee the wrath of his ripped-off citizenry. This version was used more often as the scam progressed, and Weinberg promoted his friend Abdul to the ruling rank of emir. For still others, the story was that Abdul was a lavish patron of the arts, both classic and pornographic, and was not averse to purchasing paintings, jewelry, and other items that were hotter than his native desert. At times he was also described as a connoisseur of sex films, so tawdry that Behind the Green Door, in comparison, would look like a Walt Disney production. Although he was blissfully unaware of what was going on, Weinberg's Arab pal had been cleverly fashioned into a scam for all seasons. He offered opportunity to forgers, swindlers, thieves, influence peddlers, smugglers, pornographers, and corrupt public officials and politicians. It was only natural that Abdul would have a corporation to handle these various activities. It was created by Weinberg and called Abdul Enterprises Limited. Everyone had a title, and all except Weinberg used aliases. McCarthy was chairman of the non-existent board. Weinberg was president. Fuller was financial director. Tom McShane, the FBI agent who had posed as Weinberg's art expert in the airport arrests, was art consultant. And Agent Ernie Haridopoulos, the friendly thug who had leaned on swindler Fred Proe, was executive vice president. Once the corporation was formed, Fuller fabricated a letter from a U.S. ambassador under a State Department letterhead, giving a background to Abdul, and naming the various FBI agents under their aliases as members of Abdul's staff. Fuller then constructed a ruse which time and again in the months to come made the difference between success and failure for Abscam. He called a friend at Chase Manhattan. The friend he called was listed as a high-ranking official at the bank's international department in New York. His name was Michael Elze. The bank official agreed to tell anyone who might call that Kambir Abdul Rahman had millions on deposit with the bank. Fuller correctly guessed that future Abscam targets might be suspicious of the scam and demand proof of Abdul and his money. The letter on State Department stationery would prove that Abdul existed, and Chase Manhattan would verify his wealth. Weinberg was given the direct line number for Elze. If doubting Marks asked for a financial reference, Fuller told Weinberg to give them Elze's name and phone number. Fuller's meticulous planning proved vital to Abscam. The banker was called over the next 18 months by agents for congressmen, mobsters, and even other banks. Always, he confirmed that Abdul was a multi-million-dollar customer. The bank was technically telling the truth about Abdul's hefty coffers. Before enlisting Elze's aid, Fuller had taken Weinberg's advice and persuaded the Bureau to deposit $1 million to the account. The money was part of the FBI's annual congressional appropriation. Elze, an expert on the Mideast, was the bank officer in charge of the account. When Abscam surfaced publicly, the money was returned to the government. Abscam jurors and newspaper editorialists would later wonder how supposedly intelligent people like congressmen and lawyers could have fallen for Abscam. Seen on flickering TV screens, the scam seemed too obvious. But like all great swindles, Abscam was an illusion built on careful attention to details, subtle pre-sell, and the target's own greed. Many of those ensnared by Abscam were initially suspicious. Influence peddler Howard Criden, for instance, was constantly questioning Weinberg about Abdul and his organization. But even his questions were fewer after he called Chase Manhattan. If Abscam was real, the Marks believed they would get rich. They wanted Abdul to be real, and the bank fed their hopes. What the swindle now needed was some kind of style, a way in which the various performers could act to enhance the carefully contrived plot. The style was provided by Weinberg. Weinberg was widely known in the business as a crook and swindler. If he pretended to be anything else, he would raise immediate suspicion. Faced with this known quantity, he constructed a role that allowed him to be both a crook and a semi-legitimate businessman. He created the impression that he was hugely paid by Abdul, and didn't want to do anything so outrageously crooked or disloyal that he would lose his cushy job. On the other hand, he let it be known. He was a crook at heart, and wasn't averse to jacking up the price of something that he was purchasing for Abdul and splitting the difference privately with either the seller or the agent who set up the deal. The Arab, he said, would never notice an odd million here or there. The Abscam tapes are laced with quotes from Weinberg playing this role. In one conversation with middleman Criden, He acted the careful steward to his Arab employer when Criden pressured him to buy a bank. He told Criden, "You know, when these guys come and give you something, one, two, three, I'm leery of them, okay? I don't mind something as long as we can check it out. I don't want them to think that we're idiots. You know, nobody gives up $3 million tomorrow." But on another occasion, he winked knowingly at Criden and told him, "I have nothing to hide. I'm an open book. If I can make a buck, I make a buck." Another time, Weinberg warned Camden Mayor Angelo Arricchetti, "You just can't go to his Arab employer and say, 'I need your $20 million, $30 million.'" But he also told Arricchetti, "You know, let him explain to you what he wants to do. You know, if there's a way of doing it dishonestly, I'll know how." And when he was giving a $50,000 bribe to Congressman Michael Ozzie Myers of Philadelphia, Weinberg said, "We got like the goose that lays the golden egg. We all like to make a buck." Such a role, however, has built-in problems. Any swindler tossing millions to politicians and fellow crooks would normally ask them for cash or other side gifts. It's also standard etiquette in these circles to make such goodwill presents to anyone who can move sizable amounts of money your way. As an agent of the United States government, it would be improper for Weinberg to solicit or take such gifts. But in his role as Mel Weinberg, Abdul's light-fingered representative, he would create deep suspicion if he didn't. At the ensuing trials, defense lawyers insisted that he had asked for and gotten gifts. Weinberg, a picture of wounded innocence, maintained that he did not. Abdul Enterprises now had an impressive string of corporate officers, a cavernous, if unfurnished, office, a glowing bank reference, and a unique style of doing business. Everyone was anxious to see if it worked. They decided on a dress rehearsal with a real target. But only the strength of the plot and a skillful mop-up by Weinberg saved the trial run from complete disaster.